23rd, month of November, year 2005, and we will continue from where we left off last week, at the very bottom of Avodah Zorah Lamed Zayin Omed Aleph. To refresh our memory a little bit, you remember the accusation was made against Rabbi Yossi that he was too liberal. He gave permission to too many things. What are some of the things that he gave permission to? So one of them we learned is about the oil of the Veda Zora and so on, and we learned, you know, that already had already been permitted by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi in his court because of the fact that you know, people were using olive oil and they didn't feel that this was really contributing to Avodah Zorah, and so therefore they relaxed on that. So that was one liberal decision. And then another liberal decision was in regards to locusts. So this is what we're on right now. And the third one, as we'll see, deals with the liquid that comes out of the slaughterhouse in the Beis HaMikdash. So now we're ready to talk about locusts. Okay, we talked about it at the very end of the last week's session, but for one thing, the tape ran out, and secondly, it's going to refresh our memory again. So the Gemara wants to know, what is this ayel kamsa that they're talking about over there? The Torah never uses those expressions, although it uses words like chargol, arbe, etc., etc., right? And it tries to give certain clues as to what would be a kosher locust, you know, that could be eaten. It has to be able to hop and so on. But at any rate, the sages came with certain characteristics that, you know, they decided that this would be a sign that it was a kosher locust. Namely, it had to have, first of all, four legs, then two springing legs, and then the wings of the locust had to cover most of the body. These were the simonim, okay? Just as we speak about simonim, you know, for a kosher animal, right? Pardon me?
Grasshoppers or locusts?
To me, they are, right? I don't know the difference between them. And I don't know that I would be looking forward to eating one, even if it were kosher. But since we Ashkenazim don't know these things, so we can. The Teimanim had a reputation of eating them, that they knew what was kosher and what was not, okay? So maybe if Rabbi Saidi were here, maybe he could explain
it. You don't need a shechet for that.
No, no. Well, you don't need a shechet for a fish either.
Yeah, but
the
fish is a
water
bug.
I mean, locusts are
a
thing.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Every time on the Abraham Mount always told me he had a relative who knew exactly the four kinds of locusts that you could eat. I mean, really, they all somewhere in. But none of them ever came to Israel. They were all back in Yemen.
Correct.
That's what
I didn't see any grasshopper stores.
Arba, Salam, Chargol, Chogol. These are the four kosher types. Okay. So now, he wanted to say also that the Ayel Kamsa is a kosher one, even though it was not mentioned in the Torah. That's the point. Okay? So the Gemara wants to know. No. So my Ayel Kamsa, so tell me, what is an Ayel Kamsa? So there's a difference of opinion among the Babylonians as to what is the proper name for it. Rapopo ma Shushiva. He says it's a Shushiva. Barapchiya Barami. Mishmeidu Ullah, and Rabbi in the name of Ullah said, Omar Suzbil. He says it's a Suzbil. So the question is, the Ayal Kamsa you identify either with Shushiva or Suzbil, right? So what is the difference between them? So Rapapa Omar Shushiva. He says it's a Shushiva. Because the palge b'roshayoru, right, and the machlokes is that you have to take a look at its neck as to it has a long neck. Marsova roshay oruch osur, or marsova roshay oruch mutar. One authority holds that if it has a long neck, then in that case it's kosher, mutar. And the other one says, no, it's osur, it's prohibited. So this is the machlokes then about a shushiva, whatever that may be, whatever type of locus that is. Okay. And Rab Chiya bar Ami Mishpei De'ulah, Rab Chiya bar Ami, the name of Ullah, Omar, he said, no, he said it's a susbil. So now the, yes?
Why is it important to identify the name here?
Because, obviously, if the Torah says that certain locusts can be eaten and others cannot, they want to know exactly what is the kosher type and what is the trefa type.
Yeah, but they're talking about names.
Correct. But, names. You know, okay, so now remember that Hebrew and Aramaic are not exactly the same language. That names that were familiar in Eretz Israel were not familiar in Babylonia. You understand?
So
they are trying to figure out what Babylonian locus they have, you know, to see whether it's a kosher one or not. So they could identify it. That's the point. That's what they want to know.
Long and long and long.
Right. Characteristic.
Right.
Just forbidden, and the one who has a long headed neck.
Well, but we see no. With the long neck, one authority says it's kosher, and the other one says it's not.
So who's out with the seven machlokes?
There's a seven
machlokes. They're both talking about the same insect that
right.
might have one or the other name.
Right.
Oh, so they don't know about the names.
They don't know the name. Exactly. Right. And the other one says it's a suspil. So what about the suspil? So the suspil, he says, Baroshe Oruch, he says, Kule Almale Plige the Osir, he says, if it has a long neck, then everybody agrees that it's a treif. It's no good. So that would rule out what? The shushiva. The first one. Right, right. Right. But what about this one, the susbil? So he says, the hocha, in the case of the susbil, bichnovov chofim en srubel le hadchaka biflegei. Says, the problem over here is, if the wings cover most of the body, only barely cover it.
Yeah.
Okay? This is the point of machlokes, that Mar Sova, one authority felt, Ruba called the Hubeden, we need just the slightest majority. Even let's say if it covers 51%, it's enough, okay? Well, Mar Sova, and the other authority feels, no, that's not good enough. It says, Ruba de min korbida. We have to be able to see that it really does cover most of it. Not, you know, barely cover, but it has to cover most of the body. So,
doctor?
Yes.
Well, I mean, this could either be the characteristic of the insect kind itself, or it could be the stage of growth. Could be that a young insect would only have partial wings and an older insect might have bigger wings. We had a similar situation earlier.
Maybe with scales on a fish.
Right.
It's a problem. Right. Yeah. Well, in this case, I'm not an entomologist, so I couldn't really answer your question.
Good word.
No.
That was a good word.
I lack knowledge in many, many areas.
Does Rashi have anything to say about it? Not that I need to.
Rashi is explaining primarily, but, you know, he does the best that he can under the circumstances.
Not a locus.
Right. Right. You take a look at the top, Susbil. He says, Ein Rosh Oruch. First of all, he says, this does not have a long neck. Okay? Amol Ein Kenof of Chofim Es Rubo. The Rosh Lo Einayim. In other words, the wings did not cover most of the body that it is visible. Elo betzimtzum al yedei medida. Only barely, if you measure it, can you see that it's just barely you know, just over half of the body. Okay? Yeah.
Contracted.
Right. So, this is what they're talking about. Okay. At any rate, all right. Nevertheless, what? They reproved Rabbi Yose, that they said, you know, that he was too liberal because he's giving permission to this and that and the other thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Now, the third one was about Be'al Mashke, Be'bit B'chaya D'chein. Says that, you know, the liquids that come out of the slaughterhouse in the Beis HaMikdash, that they are kosher. Cain means clean in this particular case. So, my D'chein, so tell me, what do you mean? That it's clean? So, Rav Omar, D'chein, Mamash, Wishmuel Omar, D'chein, Militami Achirim. Fundamental difference between Rav and Shmuel in their interpretation over here. Rav says what? Taket means that the liquid is absolutely kosher. Okay? It's tahor. Okay? Let's translate the word Cain as tahor. And Shmuel says it is tahor only to the extent that it does not cause somebody who comes in contact with it to become tamei. Okay? About Tumas Atzmon Yeshbahen, but they can themselves become Tomei. Because we have in the laws of Tuma, you have a million different variations.
Right.
And in some cases, we know that if you have an Afa Tuma, okay, then in that particular case, it makes whoever, you know, eats, comes in contact with food or with a keli or something, becomes tummy, and that in turn can convey tumor to the next object and so on. But what he's saying over here, what Shmuel is saying, is that in itself it can become tummy, but it does not convey tumor to anything else. This is what he's saying.
Can you give an example?
Well, I mean, you know, we don't bother anymore with Tomei and Tahor. I mean, as far as, because in olden days, first of all, it applied to going to the Beis HaMikdash, then in that particular case, you have to be in the state of purity. Therefore, you have to avoid anything which makes you impure. And secondly, if you were a Kohen, if you had to eat Truma, then in that case, the Truma had to be in a state of purity, you had to be in a state of purity. If the Truma became, came into contact with something which was not Tahor, which was Tomei, then in that particular case, the Truma itself also became Tomei, and the Kohen was prohibited from eating it, you see. So they had to be very, very careful about these things.
Sorry about Truma.
Huh?
Truma.
Truma, right. But there are other areas as well, I mean, where it applied.
The amount of truma to be given is not very specific, is it?
No, it's so about 2%.
140?
Yeah, right. Approximately 2%.
Yeah.
Right. Correct. Depending upon how generous you were or something like that. Right.
But
that's still a concept, you know, that to us is very foreign because
we don't have it, right?
Yeah. Now, even after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, there were still those who observed laws of purity, even though, you know, the Beis HaMikdash is no longer in existence. But after several centuries, it just went into discard. To a certain extent. I mean, right, the Kohen should not go in contact with the dead body or something like that. That's correct. Yeah.
In, I think it's Motzorah. They talk at the very end. I'm not sure it's Motzorah or the
Motzorah.
Right.
Motzorah.
Yeah.
Right.
I guess I should say Motzorah.
Right.
Either that or the parsha that is next afterwards, consecutively after it. At the very end, they talk about a situation where in a tent or a home, if you had something that had water, that would be that if the water drips on the on the food that
I'll call Zero Zero Shazaria. Right,
so
okay, right.
Nitame
is seed, right. Correct.
So is that what they're, is that sort of an.
That's also the verbatim, exactly. Okay. Right, yeah. There are, let's say, they had various sources of tumor. Of course, the most severe source is, you know, a dead body.
Right.
Obviously.
It's what? Does it necessarily transmit tumor?
No.
Has to come in contact with somebody else.
Right. Correct. Right. It didn't automatically make it, but, you know, it was, as we get the technical term for that is machshir. Machshir means that it makes it capable of becoming tumor.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, today when we talk about the Rava Maksha, we hope that it doesn't make the food that's kosher capable of becoming tummy. So somewhat different use of the word Maksha in this case. Okay. But Maksha means that it prepares it to, or makes it ready to, whatever. Okay. Right. Yeah. All right. So... So now, as we see, there are two different opinions. One says by itself, it's intrinsically kosher, right? And therefore, obviously, it's not going to make anything else unkosher. And Shmuel's opinion that intrinsically it could become tamei, right? But it's not going to extend the tumor to something else or to someone else, okay?
All right.
So Rav Omar Dechein Mamash, right? Rav is of the opinion that it's really Tahor. Why? Kosovar, because he's of the opinion that Tumas Mashkin the Rabbanan, that the whole business of liquids becoming unclean, this is only a rabbinical stringency.
Right.
This is not what the Torah had in mind. He goes to Rabbanan, Tuma Vemashkin, the Alma. And then when the rabbis came along and they made a gezerah, they made a decree saying that, Mashkin can become Tomei, that means Mashkin in general. Avo, Mashkin, Bebe, Tachay, and they go to Rabbanan.
Mashkin is what?
Mashkin means liquid.
Well, liquid, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
So,
of course, in Manalosha, Moshka means schnapps, you know.
Right. But does that imply that liquid itself is intrinsically tamei?
What it implies is that it's possible for it to become tamei. It could become tamei. Not by itself is it necessarily. But if a person who has contact, let's say, with a dead body, a dead... He touches the water or something like that, then in that particular case we might say, you know, that this would be already a rabbinical stringency.
Two liquids that are in that category. Water, blood.
Right, that's correct. Stuff. Water, blood. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, like,
oil.
Oil, right.
There
are
right.
Things that
right.
At all.
Yeah,
but,
correct.
But in that example, like with the tent or whatever, somebody like touched a dead person, came in with a tent, I don't know, touched a jar of water with the water in it, and the water spilled on the food. That water spilling on the food, am I correct, would make the food tamei. So the water is sort of like a conductor.
No, if you take a very strict view, definitely.
Yes, yes, the water itself won't.
If you spill
water
on the food just because it was water, it doesn't make it tamei.
No,
I don't believe so.
Oh, we're talking about...
I don't think so.
Contact with somebody who has been in contact with a dead body or something like that, you know, then you already have a different problem, okay? So, at any rate, right. So, according to Rav, he says that, the whole tumor and the liquids, this is a rabbinic stringency, but not originally a Torah one. And then when the rabbis declared that there is tuma in mashke, you know, in liquid, but what did they exempt? They exempted mashkin beimit b'chayah negoso, right? That they did not do it.
A lot of blood
right.
There.
Correct.
Oh.
Yeah.
And blood is the transmitter of
right. Kushmur lomar.
Is that, or they just feel there wouldn't be any... he wouldn't be anything that's telling
well,
me in the
Well, needless to say, nobody is... Yeah, that's a special laws. The Mesa Mikdash in general had special laws, okay? What we call Rishus, for example.
But this was a rabbi's decree, not
correct, correct, right. But the temple was a special area. I mean, things that were done in the Beis HaMikdash could not be done outside of the Beis HaMikdash. In the Beis HaMikdash, they burnt the fire, right? The Kohen was permitted to add wood to it, you understand, on Shabbos.
Right, right, right.
Because, you know, for the Korban and so on. I mean, this was something, you know, that could not be done normally outside the Beis HaMikdash.
Right.
They did not exact it as far as the liquid in the, that came in the temple slaughterhouse.
No.
Correct. One thing that we do know, however, that they had a channel over there which carried it into the Meha Shiloah, into the waters of the Shiloah. It's a little stream down below, okay? And it so enriched the soil over there that they would use it for fertilizer. Question is, you know, whether this was proper to use something which had come from the Beis HaMikdash or not. But it was rich. So the question is this a question of the Ela, which means that, you know, you've touched something which is sacred and it was a sin to do so, or not. No, I'm not going into that area right now. Right. Okay. Ushmuel Omar, Shmuel on the other hand said, Dechein, right? He says, yes, it was Tohor, but in what capacity? Militabe Achirim. It didn't carry Tumah to others, well, Tumas Asmod Yesh Bahem, right? But intrinsically, it could be. Could be Tomei by itself. Crossover, what was his reasoning? His reasoning was, Tumas Mashkin Doraisa. He says, wait a minute, the Torah itself, you know, says that it can become unclean. Letabe Achirim. That the Torah itself says Tumas Mashkin. Now, mashkin, in other words, liquids, can become unclean, but the tamei acherim, right, in order to make something that the water comes into contact with unclean, this is the Rabbanan. This is the rabbis who decreed that. If he goes to Rabbanan, the mashkin, the alba, and when the rabbis made their decree, they were decreeing only about liquids in general, but the mashkin made it the chayal negosu, right? But they did not have anything, they did not make this decree concerning specifically the liquids that came out of the slaughterhouse in the Beis HaMikdash. All right. Then,
well, again, I have to ask what Herb is asking, why? I mean, I can think of two different explanations. One is that there's nothing that's tamei in the Beit HaMikdash at all, so no liquid or solid or whatever that comes out of the Beit HaMikdash could possibly carry any
But there's a possibility of something becoming Tomei in the Beis HaMikdash.
Is there?
What if a person died suddenly in the Beis
HaMikdash? Oh, you mean just dies suddenly? But they're all
the animals themselves are clean.
Before they get
the animals are clean.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, in the sense that, the, you know, they're tar, okay?
Yeah.
I don't guarantee that, you know, in the pen where they were kept prior to being offered up their sacrifices,
yeah.
I'm sure that they urinated, they defecated, and so on.
But they were supposed to be clean.
Right.
I mean,
but ritually clean, right. They were ritually clean.
Right. Somebody could have come into the
Well,
the person who came into the Beis HaMikdash, he was expected to actually to be in a state of purity, because if he was going to partake in any sacrifice, then he then you had to be in the same pew. So they had big boys. They had big boys.
Why? Why do you say that?
They had mikvahs over there. They had mikvahs in the base hamikdash in the Harabais, where people were expected to table before they went into the base hamikdash.
People did shvamim. What about the bikurim after?
Yeah. Now, of course, the sanctity of various parts varied. I mean, the closer to the actual Oren HaKodesh, that's, you know, the most holy area. You had what they call, you know, Ezra's Yisrael. Of course, it was Ezra's Noshim, the courtyard with the women. Ezra's Yisrael, where Jewish men were, and so on and so forth. And then after that, you know, you went the highest steps, and then you have the Ezra's Hallelujah or something, you understand?
And
Ezra's Kahanim and so on. And finally you have, you know, the Kodesh Kodosh, you know.
Right.
So it goes to various states over there.
None of the children or the women were allowed to come anywhere near where the sacrifice
No.
Well, then where was the Omer brought then, and the Bikurim, and the people who had Shlomim, and were putting it on their shoulders and waving?
Okay.
Where did all that take place?
That could take place on the Esos Israel. Okay? The Omer itself, this was done by Kohanim themselves. It wasn't done by everybody. Of course, there was only one sacrifice, the Omer, where they sent out people, you know, to cut the grain and then bring it and to burn it and so on and so forth. This was done purely by the Kohanim. Okay?
You don't get that from the Torah itself. This is from history.
Right, right.
Okay.
But Bikurim, let's say he was presented in the Ezra's Yisrael to the Kohen, and the Kohen would have the ritual with him and so on. And, you know, then the Kohen took the basket from him, and the Kohen had the basket, the fruit, okay?
All right.
Yeah, because that belonged to the Kohen.
Shlomim,
again, he would bring the animal, he would put his hands on it, that's what we call smicha, and then from that point on, right, then, you know, the Kohen would take charge.
Right.
Right.
What about Sota? Where would that take place?
Sota, also. Yeah, I mean, a good deal of it was done in the Ezra's Israel itself.
So all this took place in Ezra's
Israel? Right, right, right.
Right, no?
Pardon me?
They had a procedure in Sota, but they never was exercised.
Well, theoretically, it could be exercised.
Theoretically, but
yeah,
it never was.
Yeah.
There's no indication of it.
Well, there may have been. I don't know. This, I don't say, is impossible. There are some other things that they say it never happened. The Bain Sorer Remora, for example.
Right.
You know,
it was.
Bain Sorer Remora, the rebellious child.
Born,
etc., etc. The whole business over
the
there. Right,
yeah.
Okay. So that they say never happened.
Today,
right.
You
know. Or the Ir Hadidachas, a city that would be completely destroyed because all the inhabitants are turned to idolatry or something.
Yeah,
like
the right. Gemara, yeah.
So, again, you know, they say that's why never, you know, it never came into existence, never happened, okay. But it's a marshal, it's to teach you, you know, something, okay.
We never had any jewels, any jails or anything like that.
Well, they had. They had something to detain people, right? But they tried to dispense justice as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
They did have something called the keeper, where they didn't feed it eventually, Of course, it was a dome. The keeper itself means like a dome. We learned that a long time ago. Remember when they talk about, can a Jew help in the building of an idol or a temple, up to a certain point. But when you reach the keeper at that point, no, because they always put a statue or something on top of it. Right. Okay. Now, the other one, the leniency was if a person touched somebody who had died, right?
Yeah.
the outer core of the Nisar, if it becomes Tomei, right? The core of Yosef Sharia, they call him Joe, Yosef, the one who is so lenient in his decisions. So he say, Yosef, I saw him in my life. What do you mean? If he says that you touch a dead body, you are Tomei, right? So they shouldn't call him, you know, Yosef, the one who gives permission, but Yosef who says you cannot, it's prohibited, right? The own. And not only that, but this was not a chiddush on his part, right? It wasn't something new. D'oraisa he, this already is mentioned in the Torah itself. D'chsev, as the Torah says, you know, this is the Parsha, the Paraduma, if you remember, okay? Whoever upon the face of the field touches Bachalal Kherif, someone who has been killed by a sword, Oba Mace, or touches anyone who is dead, and so on and so forth. So, the Raisa, from the point of view, okay, of the Torah, the Kherif, if you touch it, then what happens? Then Tommy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're Tommy. So what is then the leniency that Yosef was accused of making? The answer is the korev bidikur of tohor. That if somebody then touches the person who had become Tommy, right, then he himself does not become tohor. He himself remains Torah, does not become Tomei.
That's really different.
Right.
Yeah, it is different.
Right. The also in who, and then the Bezdin came along, the Godzo, and they made a Gezera, Afilo the Korev Bidikirev. In other words, Bidikrav, okay. Even if you touched someone who had touched, automatically then what? Then you became Tomei, okay? So they say, the Ukmo Adoraiso, the Kuru Nami Doraiso. And their interpretation was, when they issued this decree, that it's like a law in the Torah, that comes from the Torah itself. Deceive, as is written, again, the business with the, you know, the chapter about the Paraduma, Parsha Chuk, it's the very beginning over there. Says, and whatever the Tomei touches, in itself becomes Tomei, right? So Abaruha Rabban and Kameda Rabba, Mishmeda Mazut. So the rabbis recited this teaching of Rabba in the name of, in the presence of Rabba, right? They came to Rav and they quoted it in the name of Marzutra, the Raider of Nachman, the son of Rav Nachman. The Omar Mishmeda Rav Nachman, who said in the name of Rav Nachman, D'oraisa, according to the law of the Torah, D'korev, B'dikorev, B'chiburin, that if a person touched another one, you know, touched a dead person, right? Now, bechiburin, if they were still joined, in other words, the man touched the body, and this man touched him while he was still touching the body, that's what they mean by bechiburin over here, then in that case, tumas shiva, then in that case, he has to observe the law concerning tumah for 7 days. He remains tomei for 7 days. And the law there specifies, again, you know, if you take a look at the Parsha of the Paraduma over there, that on the third day he has to be sprinkled with mechatos, and then on the seventh day, again, he has to be sprinkled with mechatos before he can become clean, and so on. So for 7 days he's in the state of Tuma. Okay? So,
if he doesn't, if they aren't joined, then
Erev. Right. Right. But if he was not touching the person who was touching that, right? That, and that, you know, at the same time, and Tumas Erev, that it was sufficient only that he was Tuma for that day, but when the night came, he became clean. Of course, it's understood, he also has to dip in the mikveh, you know, prior to sunset, you understand?
Yeah.
That he has to do, in order to go from the state of minor impurity back into a state of purity again. Okay? The also inhu, and then the sages came along, the gods are afilu shalo b'chiburin tumas shiva. So they made a gezeira that even if, you know, person B who's touching person A, and A was not at that moment holding a dead person or touching a dead person, but nevertheless, Mr. B also contracts tumas shiva, right? 7 days. The Yosei Ihu, and then so Yosi, Rabbi Yosi came and he said, hold it, the Ukma Adoraisa, right? And he says, well, take a look at the Torah, right? Doraisa Bahi, what do we find in the Torah? The Chsiv Hadogeya Bemeis, right? The Chol Nefesh Adam, the Tomei Shivas Yomim, that if a person touches a dead body, right, where, the, you know, whatever soul of human being, then he becomes tamei for 7 days. Uchsiv, and it's written v'chol asher yigah b'yatome yitma, right? That whatever the tamei touches, that becomes tamei. Uchsiv, and now we have a pasuk that says v'yad nefesh hanogas titma ad ha'orach, and the soul that touches shall become unclean until the evening. So how do you reconcile 7 days tuma, right, with tuma simply ato arav? In other words, same day until the evening, right? Hoketzad, how? So he says, kam b'chiburin. So he says, if they're both holding on, right? He A holds on. B holds on to A while A is holding on to a tome, right? Then that of course would be what tuma shiva, right? And kan shelo v'chiburin, and the case where he touched somebody but the person was not in contact with the dead body, then in that case it's only what tumas erev, okay, until the evening. So amaluhu rava lava minu nechu lo tzislu bei bukis riki rachman. He says, hey, did I tell you don't hang any empty pictures, literally, in other words, don't disdain whatever Rav Nachman has to say. Hachi Amar Rav Nachman. This is what Rav Nachman was saying. He says, Sofek Tuma Pishus HaRabim Hiter Lahem. Rav Nachman said that the Kula, you know, the easy interpretation, you know, that was given by Yossi dealt in a different area. It was namely where there is doubtful tuma in the public domain, in the Rishus HaRab. In other words, in a public street, and then we don't know that something become tummy over there or not. So the question is, what if you stumble against it or touch it or something like that?
Yeah, accidental.
Right. So in the case of Rishus HaRabim, where it's a public domain, so he did go ahead, right? He gave them permission, and you know, they said that you did not contract tuma in the Rishus HaRabim. Okay, the whole hilchus or b'seitig abirut law, and we learn this by comparison with the law concerning the sota, ma sota Rishus HaYochid, af tuma Rishus HaYochid. Just as when the sota, right, the woman, she became tomei. Why? Did we actually see her perform the act?
No.
All that we know is that, she was sequestered with a person, right, for a certain period of time, right, about which we learned, if you remember.
He never boiled that egg.
Right.
He really wanted to do that.
So
there
were all kinds of different different opinions. Right, right.
All right. So, okay.
So, but at any rate, right.
Right.
Well, the husband accuses her. He suspects her. Accuses her. So, the tumor that she she becomes tamei where in the reshus hayochid, in the private domain. I mean, it's
right.
Behind closed doors, right? So, after reshus hayochid. So, likewise, tumor has to be in a private domain, not in the public domain. Okay. So look, Rabbi Yochanan says,
Mienko's, especially a battlefield, Mienko's, I mean, first of all, I assume they mean holding on to each other. It means that one person is touching a dead, a corpse,
right.
Another person is touching him. They don't actually hold on to each other. I mean,
right, right, grasp, correct.
Okay.
Right.
But assuming that to be the case, I mean, a battlefield is certainly never, by definition, going to be a private place. I mean, there are going to be corpses around. Somebody comes over and touches a corpse. Another person
over
and touches him.
Right.
This would just like do away with it. I mean, to make this exemption.
Okay.
We'll see what happens.
All right. No. You raise a legitimate point, but the point is they weren't thinking about that. They were thinking about what would be the difference between if there's something in the street over here,
right,
where people are going by all the time.
Right.
So are we to say that everybody who goes by the street becomes automatically tummy or not? So they said, spake tumor, where we definitely know that there's no tumor, only that there's a suspicion that there might be. Maybe there was a grave with one time over there or something like that, you understand?
Right.
So in that particular case, we say, you know, that the people are tahor. I mean, we don't declare that they're a tamei. So, otherwise, you know, you could have a whole crowd, I mean, going down the street over there, and each one would be declared tamei. So, whereas, in a private domain, there it is quite possible to figure out, you know, what tumor is. Okay. Rabbi Yochanan said, Halacha the Yemarin Kain. Rabbi Yochanan said, Taka the Halacha is the way you say it, but you do not proclaim it in public. You don't want to give people the wrong impression so that they're going to take everything too lightly. You understand?
Mm.
That's why. The Yosehu, and yet he came along. The Orile, right? And he gave him, said that it's okay, that it's fake tumor, but sure, some of it, that doesn't exist. Okay. It's a Torah. Tanya Name Hochi, likewise, we learned along the same lines. Rav Yehuda Emer, Koresh Lo Atzlohem, Yomar, Atkar Meshur Sarabim, Atkar Meshur Sayyobim. That Rav Yehuda says that what he did is to take beams and stick them in the ground. And he said, up to this point, this is Rishus HaRabim, right? And up to this point, it's Rishus HaYochid. Okay. He also the coming to Rabbi Yadai, when they came before Rabbi Yadai, Omaluhu, and he said, Omaya Bishikaso, Tivirahara, Zero Tavula. Apparently, people came before Rabbi Yadai, right? And they were walking in an area which was Tomei, was fake Tomei, right? And because, the rabbi said, let's not teach in public, you know, that you're Tohar. So they came and they said, look, we understand that we have become tummy, right? So what should we do? So he said, you know what? There's plenty of water, he says, in the river. He says, go take a dip over there, and you'll be okay.
Very good.
So I think we'll stop at this particular point
tonight. All right, thank you. It's wonderful.
Okay, today is the 7th of December in the year 2005. We continue now at the bottom of it is our Lamed Zion, Omid Beis, towards the very bottom over there. This follows really upon what we've been dealing with for several weeks. It started out with things that are prohibited because the goyim are involved, right? Okay, so we had wine, we had cheese, we had bread, and these were some of the things. Then after that, there was a question whether Rabbi Yosef ben Yehuda was too liberal in making, making very liberal decrees, and they called him, the guy who he's charming, he says everything is okay, and so on. So one of the things that that he permitted was the business about the oil, if you remember. Okay, so we saw wine, definitely it's a no-no, right?
No.
Cheese by us is also a no-no.
No.
Because it should also be Hall of Israel cheese, okay? Palter.
Palter.
Right, Palter. We learned.
P-A-L-T-A.
Yeah. P-L-T-R. Palter. Palter. Pei Lamed Tes Reish.
No, but Palter is P-A-L-T-R.
Okay. Palter is the Aramaic word for a baker.
Okay.
A baker. It's Aramaic for baker. So what it means is, in other words, it's a baker whom you can trust that he doesn't use trefa stuff, but he's not a Jew. So it's second best as far as...
But you're allowed to use it.
But you're allowed to use it, right. So...
But that only applied in those days, not now.
Well, it applied in those days, but the preference, of course, was, as I said, for Parsh Israel. And for people who were very prone, they still want to have Parsh Israel and not Parsh Kalfik. In New York, it's very easy to find it. Here in Springfield, it's not as easy. Right. The only thing that you can get over here that's considered, Parsh Yisrael is the bakery at the Big Y. Because Yitzhak is supposed to come in several times a week to take
how
a look at it.
How about the one at
Stop and Shop? Stop and Shop, that would really more qualify as a Parsh Palter. I mean, it's kosher. I mean, after all, I go in over there to examine it, I assure you that I'm very satisfied with the way things are over there. They're very careful about the distinction between milchik and parva. Everything is marked. All the work areas are different and everything else. So I'm very pleased with
the way. Why isn't it considered Pasch
Yisrael? It's not Pasch Yisrael because, for example, I don't go in over there to put on the oven. Whether it's done at the Big Y, I don't know. But theoretically, it's supposed to be done over there. Okay? So that makes a difference. What am I going to tell you? Huh? Gossam Paul is Jewish old. From my point of view, it's Parsh Palter. I wouldn't consider it really Parsh Yisrael. If there were Shomer Shabbos, I would feel differently about it, But look, they are careful as as far as many areas that they're working in. Certain breads at Gus and Paul are parav, okay? But on the other hand, they also make a lot of bread which is dairy. Dairy either because it actually contains dairy elements in it, or because they bake these breads in the dairy oven, which automatically also makes them into dairy. You understand?
So they have to label it?
Yeah. They're supposed to label it, and I come in and I label if I find that it hasn't been labeled properly and so on. the ordinary water rolls and stuff like that is parav. However, potato rolls are not. They're milchik, okay?
What rolls?
The egg rolls are parav.
Potato rolls?
Right, right.
Well,
right.
I'll tell you something else. I went in here for rye bread.
Yeah.
I told them to slice it on the parav slice.
Right.
They told me it was broken.
Yeah, yeah. It's been broken since the year one. It's been broken since the year one. I don't think that it's a tremendous avera, I mean, because it's all dry, you know. It's not wet. But,
tell me, Doctor,
you know,
what makes it
things
pot
could be a little bit better.
Is it safe to say what makes it pot Israel is it's done under the supervision of a Jew? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Jew has to have something to do with the baking process, okay?
Even if it's not owned by, even if the baker is not Jewish?
Even if the baker is not Jewish, but if the baker is, but if, you know, there's a rabbi who, let's say, who will light the fire over there, or add something to the fire or something like this, you see, so that will be the difference. Diane, I mean, Goyishon, but, you know, she's very careful. But that comes in the category of paspalter. There's no question about that. So that's the paspalter. All right. And so tonight we now continue with the next problem that was mentioned in the Mishnah, namely shlokos. What are shlokos? That's cooked foods. What can you do about food which has been cooked by a goy? You understand? All right, that's the next thing over there. Hashlokos. All right, it's the third line before the long lines, from the bottom, okay? So the Mishnah now goes into the question about this. So the Gemara immediately wants to ask, so Menohan Emile, where do you find in the Torah a reference, you know, that cooked food has to be Jewish supervised, and you can't trust the goy to do it without supervision. Okay? So, it's a very fanciful way they do it. They say, Omar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Omar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, he says, Omar Kroy, says, the Pasuk says, Ochel Bar Kesev Tashbireini V'yochalti U'mayim Bar Kesev Titen Li V'shosisi. Okay, people of Israel are trying to pass through Edom on their way to Eretz Israel, okay? And Edom is not very hospitable to them, but the Jews want to assure them that, you know, whatever food and drink that they need, they'll be very happy, you know, to pay for it. They're not there in order to make war, but they're just, you know, on their way to Eretz Israel, and they need food. So the Pasuk says, you should sell unto me food for money so that I can eat, and water also, you know, you will give me for money and I will drink. Okay, so what is the stress over here? It says kamayim, in other words, food and drink are compared in the Pasuk, correct? He mentions food and drink. So, in other words, what he's saying over here is that you can compare the food to the water, to the drink. Just as water never changes its form, so food, which never changes its form, is permissible to be eaten. Not talking about cooked at this moment. But what are we talking about?
Raw
fruits, vegetables, and so on. This we could eat. Even if we buy it from a goy, I mean, we can eat. Okay? Right. All right. Next. Then it says, V'chi Tamar.